Welcome to Econ on Mics, where we dive into the world of research with insightful conversations featuring six remarkable women economists from Asia, Africa, and Latin America. Proudly presented by the International Economic Association's Women in Leadership and Economics Initiative in collaboration with Women in Econ and Policy. Stay tuned as we uncover fresh perspectives and explore the global economic landscape.
Hi everyone, my name is Michelle Pleece. I am a postdoctoral fellow at the University of Pretoria and a research consultant for the United Nations University World Institute for Development Economic Research. As an early career researcher, I am interested in gender inequality, decision-making, and behavioral economics. Today on the podcast, we are talking about intergenerational mobility. I am excited to be sitting with Dr. Eleni Yetberg. Dr. Eleni obtained her master's and PhD in public policy and development economics from Maastricht University. Her research interests include poverty and inequality dynamics, the socioeconomic impacts of economic shocks, intergenerational mobility, impact evaluation, climate change, and behavioral economics. She is a senior lecturer at the University of Pretoria, a research fellow of the Partnership for Economic Policy, known as PEP, and a member of the Academy of Science of South Africa Standing Committee on Science for the Reduction of Poverty and Inequality. On a more personal note, I've known Dr. Eleni for a number of years, as we are both based in the economics department at the University of Pretoria. In 2019, Dr. Eleni taught a master's course on developmental economics, which I was enrolled in, and she has been a very friendly face since then. Today, very interestingly, we are speaking about intergenerational mobility. In particular, we will be speaking around two papers. The first paper is titled Share the Love, Parental Bias, Women Empowerment, and Intergenerational Mobility, which is published in the Journal of Economic Behavior and Organization. The second paper is titled Intergenerational Mobility in Education, Is Africa Different?, published in the Contemporary Economic Policy Journal. Both of these papers speak to intergenerational mobility, which could be explained as the association between parents and their adult children when investigating social and economic indicators, such as education and income. For example, does the education level of parents influence the education level of their adult children, and how could children experience upward mobility in terms of their education? That is, obtaining a higher level of education relative to their parents. I'm excited to be talking with you today because you are highlighting issues which sometimes don't obtain a lot of airtime, that being research in sub-Saharan Africa and gender. Welcome, Dr. Eleni, and thank you so much for your time today to discuss your research. Eleni, just to start us off, intergenerational mobility is one of your core research interests where you have written a number of papers. Would you like to begin by telling us a bit about this research?
Thank you, Michelle. First of all, thank you for having me. And Michelle, it's really great to chat with you about some of my work and in your future. Today, we are going to discuss two interrelated papers that you mentioned, in which we try to investigate intergenerational mobility in Africa. In the first study, we just analyzed the trend, the level, and pattern of intergenerational mobility of education in 9 sub-Saharan African countries over 15 years. And we emphasize on gender differences. And in the second study, we try to explore the relationship between parental gender bias, which we call a psychic cause, a simple term we use to capture parental attitude or pessimism on their children's adulthood outcome that might determine investment in children's human capital, including their education and health, for instance, and intergenerational mobility for daughters and sons, as this gender bias can manifest in various forms, such as difference in educational opportunities, access to resources, and even societal expectation placed on sons versus daughters within a family and in a society. In short, we are trying to understand how parental gender bias towards sons over daughters affects their ability to achieve upward mobility across generation. And in the second paper, we are specifically looking at occupation, which we define as exit from agriculture sector, given parents being employed in the traditional sector, agricultural sector.
I find your research extremely fascinating. While reading your papers, you can almost visualize the individuals in the scenarios that you explain fully in your papers. And for example, you talk about like children being born in poverty are likely to remain in poverty as they have limited opportunities that are perpetuated by society and so on. And I think you put it down on paper so well. What motivated you to study intergenerational mobility in sub-Saharan Africa? And why did you specifically look at the mobility of daughters, in other words, women?
The simple answer is I am a woman from Africa, right? But in a very serious note, economic growth in many African countries, especially before the pandemic, has been a source of recent discussion in development space. If I use the wording of economists, they call it the formerly hopeless continent is gradually becoming the hopeful one, right? As you know, Ethiopia and Rwanda were some of the fastest growing economies in the world for 2 decades, having an average of almost more than 7% per year. But it's less clear whether the gain in this economic growth has been shared equally within those countries. And because we don't have data that allow us in understanding social mobility and equality of opportunity in the continent. In general, the assumption of a relative equitable distribution of resource should be contested in the region, as we are having a growing base of evidence that shows that inequality is actually on the rise in many African countries, including those I mentioned. And if we look at, you know, default terms such as education and gender parity, improvements are not automatic, right? We are still having the gender difference. And as an African women development economist, actually, this trend makes very curious, right? But most importantly, and from a policy point of view, we need more research to understand those trends, to reinforce policy, informed policy making. And in general, I think we need more empirical evidence in quantification of social mobility that captures the change in individual socioeconomic situation, either with respect to their parental background, which is intergenerational mobility that my work is focusing on, or a change in person's socioeconomic situation throughout their life, which is intragenerational mobility, right? And this is because social mobility is linked to equality of opportunity, right? The extent to which people have the same chance to do well in life, regardless of their background, right? Their parents, their gender, their sexual orientation, race, anything that's beyond their control. So if individuals from disadvantaged background have fewer opportunities to climb on the socioeconomic ladder, despite their effort and willingness to take risk, then there should be, you know, a measure to mitigate the impact of social and economic disadvantage at source. And I think this is a very good motivation to work on social mobility in Africa. Then the focus on mobility of women is driven by the recognition of the important role of gender in shaping development outcomes in the continent. Women and girls in Africa play a vital role within their families, both as an income earner and caregivers, like the rest of the world. But unfortunately, often they face intersecting forms of discrimination and disadvantage, limiting their access to education, healthcare, employment, and other essential resources. And this does not only limit their own socioeconomic advancement, but also might perpetuate a cycle of poverty and inequality within families and communities. So by examining the intergenerational mobility of women and daughters with my research, I'm attempting to uncover the underlying mechanism that either facilitate or limit women's ability to challenge the socioeconomic barriers and achieve upward mobility. But in general, understanding these dynamics is quite important for designing targeted interventions and policy reforms to promote gender equality and women empowerment. I also think that focusing on women and their daughters acknowledge the intergenerational transmission of advantage or disadvantage, right, between them. And investing in mobility or investing in empowerment do not only benefit them individually, but also has an effect for the whole society. And we know that empowered mothers are likely to invest in their children's education more, in their health and well-being. So by breaking the cycle of poverty and contributing to a broader socioeconomic progress, and I think we have quite significant work in prominent economists like Esther Duflo Stephen Klanz, Nancy Pover, highlighting the importance of addressing gender disparities and empowering women as a means to achieve broader development goals and improve social mobility. So in some sense, my research on intergenerational mobility in Africa with specific focus on women is rooted in a recognition of their transformative potential of empowering women and girls as a key driver of sustainable, inclusive development in the region. And hopefully this kind of research provides valuable or useful insight into the complexity, interplay of gender, dynamics, economic development, family structure, cultural factors in shaping social mobility in the region.
That's amazing. And I think Africa is such a complex and almost unique landscape to investigate these issues, as you mentioned, like the number of inequalities that we are seeing and so on. And given these factors, we can't always expect all of the regions, so say, for example, the developed versus the developing world, to always give the same kind of relationships. And that's why it's so important to study sub-Saharan Africa as a whole. But intergenerational mobility has not been well explored in developing countries due to the lack of available data. In order to study intergenerational mobility, one would require data relating to parents and their children. What was unique about the data sets you used to look at families' educational attainment in sub-Saharan Africa?
So the data we are using are first nationally representative, right? And it provides us with information on social origin of adults in some African countries. This actually means that the survey we used for our studies collect information on both children and their parents' education and occupation or sector of employment in some instance, regardless of whether the parents are still living with their children. And if they are alive, for instance, live in the same household. And this has a very important implication in our estimate, right? Because if we use co-residence identification, it has at least three important implications, right? Firstly, because the distribution of education across generation is different in the subsample of adults who are still living together with their parents versus the total population. Using a sample of children who are still living with their parents introduce some sort of sample selection, which might underestimate the true level of mobility between generations. And as I argued before, this kind of information is important to inform policy. Yeah? The data is quite generous in that sense that it collects data from everyone. Yeah? And second, co-residency criteria might over-identify younger children who are still living with their parents. And this might not lead to a representative adult population, which challenges the external validity of our estimate. And finally, this kind of data doesn't really allow us to do a kind of profile long-term trend analysis on intergenerational mobility, which is quite interesting by itself from policy point of view. We have different reforms in education sector in Africa for a while now, looking at the long-term trend, might give us some sort of idea what would be the possible effect of those interventions on intergenerational mobility in the long run. But still, there are some limitations to the data we used, our unit of observations are children, and if parents are not alive or are not living with their children during the data collection, then it's the children that report the highest level of education of parents and their occupation. So we are using respective data, right, in which measurement error could be a problem. But again, it's possible to assume that children might remember their parents' education and occupation compared to their income. So because we are using occupation and education, to some extent, we feel like we are sick. But all in all, the data we use is unique in such a way that it captures information on both children and their parents' education and sector of employment, regardless of whether parents are alive or if alive, live in the same household.
Wow. Yeah, it sounds like such a complex data collection to almost make sure that you are tracking generations and so on. And it sounds like a costly endeavor. So no wonder there's a lack of available data. But let's switch gears a bit and talk specifically about the paper titled Share the Love, Parental Bias, Women Empowerment and Intergenerational Mobility, Very broadly, this paper looks at intergenerational occupational mobility of sons and daughters. For example, what is the likelihood of sons and daughters working in a traditional or modern sector, given the association of parents working in either traditional or modern sector? So, Eleni, in this paper, you measure the effect of two mechanisms which could have an effect on gender-based intergenerational occupational mobility. One mechanism is parental gender bias, and the second is women's intra-household bargaining power. Why did you think it was necessary, and what led you to investigate these channels?
So, as you know, Michelle, many countries in Africa are faced with deep-rooted gender disparities, right, that cut across various areas, including education, employment opportunities, even decision-making within a family and within a household, right? So these disparities can be perpetuated by parental gender bias, which might influence investment in children's education and the opportunities, right? And cultural norms heavily influence parental decision-making, reinforcing gender inequalities across generations. We all claim that we love our children equally, right? Regardless of their gender or any other characteristics. But the evidence suggests the contrary, right? Several studies document boys fare better than girls, particularly in countries such as India. I would assume that it would be the same in most African countries. Boys tend to receive more and more child care. They are breastfed longer, right? They get more dietary supplements. If you look at the data from African countries, you can see that a discrepancy, even in educational attainment, for instance, this expansion of primary education, right, in those countries. And to complicate things more, I think in many developing countries, women often possess limited bargaining power within their household, limiting their access to resource and decision-making autonomy, right? And this lack of agency impacts their ability to invest in their children's future, perpetuating the cycle of gender-based intergenerational persistence or reducing mobility. Yeah? Understanding how women navigate intra-household dynamics, sheds light on the mechanism through which gender disparity are either reinforced or challenged in those countries. Yeah? So in the paper, we argue that by understanding the effect of parental gender bias and women's intra-household bargaining power, which are two important mechanisms through which gender inequality persists, we can design and implement a targeted intervention that aimed at empowering women and challenge mandatory norms within a household that can break, you know, the cycle of intergenerational poverty and inequality. By investigating those mechanisms of parental gender bias and women intra-household bargaining power, we are trying to provide insights into the dynamics of gender-based intergenerational mobility in some African countries, and addressing gender disparities within the household might be, you know, a fundamental way to build a more equitable future, right, for all individuals in the region.
Reading this paper, I found it fascinating that you studied these two mechanisms, especially due to number 5 of the Sustainable Development Goals, which speaks to gender equality and women's empowerment. And I think that by starting at home, where potentially bias can first occur, is such an important channel to investigate. Eleni, can you explain how you measure the parental gender bias, which is also called the psychic cost, in your paper?
So in the paper, we used age at marriage, right, specifically early or child marriage, as a proxy for parent psychic cost. And this is motivated by different reasons. Culturally, the age at which individual marries is deeply dependent in societal norms and expectations, right? Early marriage, particularly for girls, often reflect a social and family pressures rather than individual preferences. So parents may perceive a psychic cost in delaying their daughter's marriage, potentially impacting her future opportunities and outcome. And this is a good reason to use a child age for marriage to proxy parental psychic cost. But moreover, early marriage often disrupts girls' education, right, and limits their opportunity to human capital accumulation. So parents might weigh, you know, the psychic cost of delaying their daughter's marriage against the potential benefit of investing in her education, and which is a big determinant for future earning potential, right? And economically, I mean, early marriage can have a significant implication for families in a resource-constrained setting, particularly in developing countries. So parents might view early marriage as a means of reducing financial burden, which is associated with caring for daughters and ensuring actually her economic security through marriage, right? And this perception of psychic cost might stem from different factors, such as bride price, right? Or opportunity for economic advancement through marriage, right? Through the future son-in-law. So using age at first marriage as a proxy for parental psychic cost allow us to explore this complexity of culture, economic, and social factors in shaping parental attitudes and behavior towards their daughter compared to their sons. And their well-being future prospects and provides, I think, a good insight into a trade-off parents make between immediate social or economic gain and long-term investment in their daughter's future, I guess.
Thank you so much for that, Eleni. What was the effect of parental bias on intergenerational occupational mobility for daughters compared to sons? Do you think this effect is unique to countries which have strong social norms about women?
Well, this is quite interesting, right? So, I mean, the effect of parental bias on intergenerational mobility for daughters compared to sons was notable. It was big and significant, suggesting that, you know, parental bias has a differential impact on adulthood occupational outcome of children based on just their gender. And we specifically found that the effect of late marriage on daughters' engagement in the modern sector is smaller compared to sons, suggesting gender norms could be an important factor in explaining difference in intergenerational mobility between men and women. So overall, our findings are indicating that daughters face different challenges in achieving upward mobility compared to sons. I mean, the effect of parental bias on intergenerational mobility might be indeed, you know, more pronounced in countries with strong social norms, such as Nigeria, right? In those countries where societal expectations regarding women's role are particularly rigid, parental bias might be quite high, right? Leading to a greater disparity in intergenerational mobility between genders. And again, this can perpetuate a cycle of inequality, might limit the ability of daughters to overcome barriers to upward mobility. But it's also important to recognize that parental bias can exist across societies. In a different degree, right? Even in a context with a relative progressive attitude towards gender equality, parental bias might persist in a very subtle form, right? So while the effect of, you know, parental bias on intergenerational mobility might be more pronounced in countries with strong social norms about women, which I believe include many of African countries, I believe that it is a relevant factor in shaping outcomes across diverse cultural and social contexts.
Yes, Eleni, that's extremely important. And as you mentioned earlier, previous work on intergenerational mobility has focused largely on fathers and sons. You mentioned a paper that took place in India. Based on your findings, what did you notice about the impact of mothers' human capital on children's mobility? And was this impact stronger or weaker relative to that of their fathers?
Yeah, so previous research on intergenerational mobility, particularly in developing countries, has predominantly, you know, centered on examining the relationship between fathers and sons, in most instances driven by availability of data. Based on the findings of our study, we observed a significant insight into the impact of mother's human capital or mother's background on children mobility, right? Contrary to the traditional focus on fathers, both studies revealed that mother human capital or education or occupation had a substantial influence on children's mobility compared to that of fathers. In fact, the impact of mother's background was not weaker relative to the fathers. Rather, it was equally significant. And this, again, underscores the importance of considering maternal influence on intergenerational mobility research particularly in developing countries where such insights are often overlooked. In general, mothers play a vital role in shaping their children's outcome, including their education, occupational choice, understanding the impact of a mother's background on children's mobility. Essential, I think, to promote upward mobility and reduce intergenerational persistence or equality, right? So all in all, in both studies, our findings emphasize the need to broaden the scope of intergenerational mobility research to include maternal background with paternal influence as well, right? To understand the mechanisms through which economic outcome persist across generations to inform policy.
For me, it was fascinating that you found mothers relative to fathers' human capital had a stronger effect on their children, where I feel like there may be a preconceived notion from social norms that women can only contribute to their children's upbringing if they are at home caring and bringing up their children. So potentially moving away from these gender norms and not restricting women to the home can be beneficial for children, which is such an important finding. Eleni, are there any other striking findings or discoveries that you would like to highlight?
I think there are several findings that really deserve some attention or highlights in both papers, right? As I mentioned earlier, the key finding is that, the existence of gender-based intergenerational mobility, right? We cannot really assume that because now education is more accessible, daughters and sons would benefit from this opportunity, right? We are challenging that assertion. And the findings also underscore the significant impact of bias, right? Particularly gender bias on intergenerational mobility, difference in parental psychic costs that reflects their pessimism about their children's future, leads to, disparity in human capital investment, which will affect good outcomes such as occupation choice and their income, right? And this really highlights the need to address parental bias as a key factor in promoting gender equality and social mobility in our society. Yeah? We also found that intra-household bargaining power, particularly women's relative human capital compared to their partner within the household, influence intergenerational mobility, yeah? While higher bargaining power leads to a greater upward mobility for boys and girls, at least in Nigeria, the effect is more beneficial, right, for boys, which is a little bit worrisome. But it is one driving force behind gender-based intergenerational mobility, right? Addressing this gender bias, I think promoting more empowerment and improving intra-household bargaining power of women might have a good effect on promoting child mobility in the long run.
I agree. All of those findings were very interesting. In your paper, where you look at the intergenerational mobility of education, the finding that was most notable to me was daughters' education attainment is more correlated to parents' education than that of sons. And I guess that just speaks to the persistence of the social norms in society. And yeah, I just thought that was very interesting. Talking more generally now, what is the policy value in knowing what affects intergenerational mobility and how it is changing?
Key drivers of mobility, such as parental bias or intra-household dynamics, I think we can implement policies that address these barriers, right, and create more equitable opportunities for individuals. And as I argued before, intergenerational mobility is closely linked with social mobility, right, which is essential for promoting inclusive growth and reducing poverty, right? So by understanding factors that facilitate or hinder mobility, policymakers can implement policies that promote equal access to education, employment, or any other opportunities, enabling individuals to improve their adulthood outcome, regardless of their family background, right? And greater or higher social mobility can contribute to economic growth by ensuring that talent and potentials are not wasted due to barriers in any community, and enabling women to reach their full potential shouldn't be considered as a charity or favor, right? Policies that promote women mobility can enhance productivity, can enhance innovation, and overall, economic progress in our society. So it should be considered as a win solution for everyone. And it's possible, you know, to assume that in society where opportunities for mobility are limited, social cohesion may be also undermined, right? So by promoting intergenerational mobility, policymakers can build trust and solidarity within communities and fostering a sense of fairness that benefits the society as a whole, I think.
I loved what you said about policies for women shouldn't be seen as charity. And if you don't mind, I think I'm going to use that going forward in future endeavors. But Eleni, speaking specifically about education, how could increased investments in public education, particularly secondary education, impact mobility? And what changes would you expect to see?
So I think increased investment in general in education would likely to lead to expanded access to education, right, for a broader segment of population, including those who have disadvantages in life. Expanded access can help reduce disparity in educational attainment and will help us to increase a pool of individuals who have opportunity to pursue higher education and at the end get a better paying jobs, right? And I think the evidence is clear that individuals who complete secondary education, for instance, are more likely to pursue further education, leading to a higher level of human capital accumulation and better prospect for employment and upward mobility. Yeah? By providing, you know, equal access to quality secondary education, improvement investment in secondary education can help reduce inequality in educational opportunities and other outcomes. But most importantly, this can also help level the playing field for individuals from disadvantaged groups and contribute to a greater social mobility to enable them to overcome barriers to success, right? We don't choose where we are born, who are our parents, and etc. And it shouldn't really determine, you know, adulthood outcome, right? Any society should reward risk-taking and individual effort rather than a background, right? Investing in public education can foster social cohesion, right? By promoting equal opportunity and shared, I think, values. I strongly believe that education in general makes the opportunity cost of fighting very high, right? And improving social participation. A well-educated population is better equipped to participate in democratic process, engage in civic life than fighting. And all these have a potential to contribute to build more inclusive and more cohesive society. And I think investing in education in general have a bigger role in leveling the field for everyone, despite, you know, our different backgrounds.
Absolutely. I find it so incredibly important that if we would just have these initiatives that improve the access to education for all individuals, this would reduce like the inequality of opportunity, which we find so stark, especially in Africa. And then we can just improve the educational outcomes and hopefully move towards this upward intergenerational mobility in education. Dr. Eleni, if we move to like the general literature, how does intergenerational mobility in the African countries you have studied compare to mobility in Indian and some of the Latin American countries?
It's very challenging to make direct comparisons across regions and across countries because of the type of data we use and because we also estimate different measures. For instance, most studies, as you mentioned before, focus on fathers and sons. Some studies use co-residence, right, to construct the sum, and we also use different measures in different studies. Right? But if we consider a handful of papers that use consistent method and look at education mobility, most African countries show greater intergenerational education mobility than Latin American countries, but lower mobility compared to India. Again, there are some caveats to this statement, right? First, for instance, in our study, we only have like 9 African in our sample, which doesn't represent Africa in any way. And second, some of the survey data we used is too old. A good example is the data we use for Rwanda. It could be, you know, the case that educational attainment is very low in both generations, for instance, in Rwanda. And our measures are not really capturing the intergenerational persistence of education across generations. and suggesting more mobility in Africa than in Latin America, such as Brazil or Peru. But given, you know, the evidence we have at hand, one can argue that Africa is doing better than Latin American countries, where inequalities in general are quite high. But one has to consider the caveats that comes with this kind of statements as well.
It almost seems like each country should be almost used as its own case study regarding like the data limitations and the social norms and the cultural effects that all have an effect on this intergenerational mobility. So I guess this just means that there's a lot more work to be done, which is a good thing for us. And lastly, do you have any recommendations for further reading on this topic, a book or any papers? Or are there any colleagues whose work would be interesting to people wanting to know more?
I think in social mobility literature, there are several papers from Chatty and his team in Maastricht. They use big data, administrative data, you know, to analyze the trend in latency. And you know, challenging the notion that, you know, advanced countries such as the US are still, you know, the land of opportunity, right? So that's a must read. Eh? And looking at the work in Africa, I think the study by Xavier Lambert, Martin Rabalion, and Dominique Dewal on intergenerational mobility and interpersonal inequality in Senegal is also great, right? So instead of assuming there is equal distribution of resource in the country, we are trying in a household, they are trying to look at how resources are distributed within the household and how that really affects mobility in those countries. And I strongly believe that in general, the literature on intergenerational mobility in Africa should move that way. So that's also a great read. Capital in 21st Century or A Brief History of Inequality by Piketty is also a great book in showing how wealth is concentrated among few people and how this will reduce mobility for those who are born into poor backgrounds, right? And to understand the extent of the problem, I think the book by Piketty is quite great. Huh? So we cannot really sit and wait to fix social mobility, right? This is something that should be thought of and addressed by different measures by policymakers. Huh? But it's also important to note that, you know, that the effect of gender bias is not limited to observable outcomes, right? Such as intergenerational mobility in education or occupation. Huh? Women may internalize societal stereotypes and they might feel they are less capable or competent compared to their main counterparts. And when they face a situation or a labor market where stereotypes are activated, such as in male-dominated environment, women may experience self-doubt and might have a feeling of being an imposter, right? So in that regard, I think I recommend you recent with Nikki, Nikki Nicholas, right? Which explores the role of imposter as a potential student decision to study, right? So these are my few recommendations in terms of reading more on intergenerational mobility and gender bias.
Thank you, Dr. Eleni. I think you've given the listeners quite a few reading materials to go put on their Kindles or however they read these days. But thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me today. Your research is absolutely fascinating, and I cannot wait to read what comes out next from you. This conversation was really insightful. And yeah, just all of your findings and recommendations and your insights are really appreciated. So thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Michelle. I really appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Thank you for joining us. A special thanks to our brilliant speakers and interviewers for their valuable contributions. Share your favorite moments using the hashtag #AmplifyingVoices and stay tuned for more impactful discussions.